From Poland and Brazil, and our good friends at 9to5 Mac, this is Stacktrace, your friendly podcast about spelunking, looking into what Apple might be doing or not doing, and speculating about it all. With me, John Sandell, and of course, my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Rambo?
Doing great, John. So we are both back to our normal schedules and locations, right?
Exactly. We're back where we belong. Back in the comfort of our homes.
Yeah, that's nice. It's so good to travel, but it's also good to go back home.
Yeah, absolutely. We actually have a saying. We were talking about sayings a lot during this trip, like comparing sayings between different countries. This was really interesting because I spoke to some people from Germany and they had kind of similar sayings to what we do in Sweden, but kind of different. And then your sayings, like from Brazil, were completely different. But we do have a saying about this in Swedish, which is being away is good, but being at home is the best.
Awesome.
Yeah, so true. So we had a great trip. We were at the App Builders Conference in Switzerland, and we were recording from Italy last week. That was a lot of fun in our hotel room. We had a great trip. We visited Milano, we visited Verona, and we visited Venice. Which one was your favorite, Rambo?
Oh, that's a tough question. Going to maybe disappoint some people, depending on my answer.
But
yeah, anyway, I think my favorite was Verona, because it's so nice, the food was great, and there are so many things to see. Venice is different, so it's also very nice, but it's more like it's water. And Verona has a little bit more variety, I think.
Yeah, I really, really like Verona as well. I think it's such a picturesque, beautiful city. Like, and it's so small. You can just walk around and you don't have to worry about getting from A to B. And like in Venice, it's very interesting. You have a very interesting problem, which is it turns out that when the streets are made of water, you can't just cross them wherever you want, right?
Exactly.
You have to find a bridge. I love Venice too. This is the second time I went there. And it's really just very interesting and fascinating city. But I do agree with you. I think Verona wins the prize of our favorite city in Italy so far.
Definitely. And I am sure going to be back eventually.
Yeah, absolutely. So what have you been up to since you came back home?
Not much. I arrived here on Sunday, late morning. Was quite a long trip because I had to take a flight from Venice to Lisbon, and then from Lisbon to São Paulo, and then from São Paulo to Florianópolis. So that's quite a trip.
Yeah.
And I arrived quite tired, as you might imagine. So yeah, that's what I did. I had some lunch and then slept for a couple of hours and went back to my regular routine and coding, spelunking and stuff like that. And I'm just now getting back to my normal self after all of this traveling. Because remember, I had traveled from Canada to Switzerland.
Yeah.
So I had been traveling for almost 2 weeks.
Yeah, it was the Rambo World Tour, right?
Exactly.
The first leg of the Rambo World Tour.
Definitely, yeah. So just now getting back to my normal routine. And I'm starting to do some stuff for the WWDC app for Mac, because WWDC is just around the corner, fortunately, and there's some stuff that needs to be done in the app that we want to do for this year, so I'm starting to work on that.
And they're always slightly tweaking the JSON schema, right? So that you always have to do some change to your underlying models for each year, is that right?
Almost every year, with the version they released like a week before the event, there's some change to the JSON structure and I have to fix it. So we'll see this year. It looks like they finally arrived at a structure they're happy with.
And nice.
they released actually an update recently, but it was I can't call it a minor update. It wasn't like a full version update, but they added localization in some languages. So now the content the app downloads is localized as well. But we're not going to be doing that for our app, at least not yet. So it doesn't really change anything for us. So should be fine this year. Fingers crossed.
Nice. Yeah, for anyone who hasn't yet tried the WWDC app, it's definitely my favorite way of watching WWDC content. And I'm just not just saying that because you're here, Rambo. but it's like, and it's a native app, you know, it makes it super easy to search and to get a hold of all the videos that you want to watch. And I will definitely be watching pretty much all the videos from WWDC, and I will be doing it through that app.
Yeah, I usually just watch, I check out the schedule, and then I add stuff I'm interested in to my favorites. If it's something I'm really into and I want to watch it live, I add it to the calendar event or add a reminder. Both things are supported by the app. The app has support for NS user activity, so if you have a session selected, you can ask Siri to add a reminder for it, and it does. And yeah, that's what I usually do. And then I watch sessions, I add bookmarks to important parts of sessions, and I share sessions. So it's a very complete tool for your WWDC content consumption. And how about you, John? What have you been up to?
So when we were on the trip, like both at the conference and then afterwards when we were hanging out in Italy, like I started feeling like really, really motivated. Like I had this feeling that, you know, it was really good for me to step away from everything for a couple of days. Like usually when I go on some trip or, you know, I take some vacation, I usually like I have my laptop or my iPad with me, and I usually do like some work here, some work there. But even though I was hanging out with the developers all this time, I wasn't doing almost any like development work. I wasn't doing almost any writing. Like I was just, you know, hanging out with people and really taking some time off these past couple of days. And I felt that was really, really great because it just motivated me a lot to like when I was going to come back to really, really, really accelerate my work on a few projects that I've been working on for a while. So two projects that I've been really focusing on yesterday and today, and I will keep doing it this week, is both my new website, which is going to be generated using my still-in-progress static site generator, which is also progressing really, really well. I think I have the content collection part of the of the static site generator, which will actually be its own separate tool. It's almost ready to go now, so this is going really, really well. And I've also been working a little bit on the open source app that I'm working on. So I have all these projects now, and I really want to just like get them done. So I'm feeling really motivated to do that, which is really great.
That's nice. And I also happen to know that you've been doing some stuff in Imagine Engine, right?
Yeah, that's true. So I have Imagine Engine, which is my game engine. And I was talking to Rambo yesterday that, you know, I've wanted to do for a while like a benchmark on the new iPad Pro. So I wanted to like run like a really heavy scene with lots of characters and just to see like how well the new iPad Pro running Imagine Engine can really just sustain 120 frames per second frame rate. So I was talking to you and I was saying, okay, so I'm adding 100 characters to the scene. And I thought 100 characters all moving, animating, you know, walking across the screen. Surely that's going to, you know, at some point, once the characters move enough, going to cause some frame to be dropped. Nope. It ran buttery smooth, no problems. And then I was like, okay, 200, how about 300, 400? And I was adding at that point up to 700 characters, and it was all rendering 120 frames per second, which is just really, really cool to see. It's cool for me from two perspectives. It's both cool to see just like how performant Imagine Engine is, and also just how crazy powerful the new iPad Pro is.
Yeah, because it even has to render twice as many frames as other devices because it runs at 120. And even then, it was working very well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, zero dropped frames. Like, I still haven't found the actual breaking point, like, when it will start dropping frames, but I will keep trying and see when that is. And I also use this data a little bit to optimize the engine, because once you really push a device like this, which has all this power, to the extreme, and it starts dropping frames, the data set that you have is so large that it becomes much, much easier to see bottlenecks. So for example, like, you know, if I'm able to push like thousands of characters on the screen and I start dropping frames, I can probably see somewhere in that data, like in the textures that are loaded or in the events that are triggered, like where the bottleneck is. And that will enable me to just further optimize the engine, which I've been doing a lot. Like the reason I love working on Imagine Engine is just because it's such a fun programmatic challenge. Like it's just, you really have to optimize every single little part of it in order for it to run smoothly. And this is the first time I've also ever used a binary tree ever in my life, which is a fun thing.
So now you can do a job interview.
Yeah, finally I can get a job in Silicon Valley. I finally know how to build a binary tree.
Awesome.
Nice. So on this episode, we don't want to talk about binary trees. We want to talk about a few different topics. The first topic that we want to talk about is cross-platform third-party UI frameworks. And we're not talking here about like React Native. We're not talking about Electron or these like cross-platform programming languages or frameworks. We're more talking about the design languages that different companies are releasing on different platforms. We also want to talk about some new information and some new scoops that have been coming out from Gurman at Bloomberg. And I know that Rambo, you have some info to add to those as well. So I think it's going to be a good episode. But let's go ahead and kick it off and talk about third-party UI frameworks. So right now, there is both Google, who has the Material Design, which they primarily we're building for Android, but they've also released it for iOS, and their own apps is using the same Material Design on Android and on iOS. And we also have Microsoft, which has recently brought their Fluent design system in a framework called Fabric, if I understood it all correctly, which is also the same kind of idea, which is a cross-platform design language for all of Microsoft's products. So, Rambo, I know that you have some thoughts on this, on these kind of big companies that are not Apple, kind of bringing their own design languages onto Apple's platforms. So why don't you kick us off with your kind of initial statement about this?
So my main opinion is not about them bringing the frameworks. The fact that they're bringing the frameworks is not that big a deal. I think they should do it, but the problem I have is with the result that comes out of using these frameworks. And if you use, say, the YouTube app on iOS, it doesn't feel right because it's not following Apple's guidelines for UI. And of course, guidelines, they are just guidelines. You can go beyond them sometimes, but there's a certain point where you diverge so much from the guidelines that it just feels like it's something foreign to the platform. So that's my main opinion and why I feel like using these frameworks is not a good idea.
Yeah, the problem is a little bit like these kind of design systems, they go beyond just the visuals, right? They also encode a lot of behavior into the system itself. So when you say that the YouTube app doesn't feel right, I assume you're talking about things like, you know, scrolling, and you're talking about like how it feels to interact with different elements and maybe like even media controls. And this is something, talking about YouTube, I really feel when I'm using the YouTube app on the Apple TV, because that one kind of suffers or exhibits the same kind of, you know, problem as far as I see it, which is like when you're used to a certain interaction model, especially when you are watching TV, which is, you know, you're just swiping through content and you just want to find something to watch. Having these apps that kind of very, very heavily goes away from the standard Apple interactions, it kind of becomes problematic because you're really expecting a certain behavior, but these apps that uses this different design systems, they really have very different behaviors in these regards.
Yeah, and the YouTube app specifically, I think it's the main one I'm used to using on a regular basis. It has some strange behaviors that I'm not sure if they are a result of using a custom UI thing, or if they are just a result of lack of attention to detail or just bugs. But right. When you scroll in the home screen, and I'm actually doing it right now, the header, it disappears and reappears following your scrolling, which is a fairly standard behavior, and you can get it for free with navigation controllers. But it does it in a super weird way where it changes the speed of the scrolling as it's appearing, so it's not very nice. And they have this feature for premium users, which is the option to download videos. And it will only download videos if the app is in the foreground. If you open Control Center and close Control Center while downloading a video, it will restart the download.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, which is not nice.
I doubt that has something to do with material design in particular, right? That's probably just either a bug or just not backgrounding implemented correctly or something like that.
That's like not being a good platform citizen.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's definitely true, or it could be true. So, yeah, I agree with you that the fact that the behaviors are different can be kind of jarring as an iOS user. And I wonder sometimes like whether or not it's just us that are like a bit nitpicky about these things because we're big fans of Apple and we like the way iOS works. But, you know, I really do also think that even average users can sometimes notice these things and really like it can feel a little bit alien, like you say, that these are not good platform citizens. So that's one thing. But on the other hand, I'm also kind of happy that different companies are also thinking about design in different ways and also to bring it to iOS and kind of modify it a little bit to say, here is something that runs on iOS, it's an iOS app, but it could also work like this, or it could also look like this, because that's also a little bit where innovation happens, right? And, you know, when an app like, for example, Snapchat first came out, like, there was this funny thing where it was like, you need to be a teenager to use Snapchat, right? Because all the people who are not teenagers, they couldn't figure out how this, like, swipe thing worked. But now, a couple of years later, so many different apps are using very, very heavily swipe-based navigation. Maybe not to the extent of Snapchat, but I just kind of like when there are different companies that are not just accepting the status quo, but they're kind of pushing the platforms in different directions, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that's a great use case for customization. I'm just not sure if these are really that, because they're basically just taking something that's being used in another platform and translating it to iOS. So basically you can make a quote-unquote Android iOS app with material design.
Right.
which is kind of funny. But I like these innovations. I think Snapchat is still hard to use for me.
Yeah, well, I agree.
I'm too old for this.
Yeah.
But I think it's kind of the difference between the library and the framework we've been talking about. I think we talked about this on the trip. The library, you call the library, the framework, it calls you.
Right, so exactly.
These are very big frameworks that completely change everything. Instead of like small pieces of UI that innovate in some way, like I can give some examples, like the Sur app for Apple Music. It has this really cool thing where you can pull to reach, so you can pull down on the screen and it will cycle between different UI controls that are on the top, so you can't reach them easily, but you can by pulling. Yeah. And it works really well, and it was implemented in a very nice way, but it's not a standard iOS thing. But that's like one little thing within this app that still follows most guidelines and still feels like an iOS app.
Yeah, that's a really good example. And I do agree also that I like when designers and developers kind of augment the platform rather than just completely replacing it, right? Where I would also say that Microsoft's approach here with the Fluent design system is more that than material design. Like, material design for me feels like just replacing the whole thing, right? Like, like you said, let's just throw iOS. Let's forget that we're running on iOS. Let's pretend we're on Android. Let's just bring the whole design language over and just have it be there. Sure, they make some slight tweaks here and there to make it more iOS-like, but in general, it's more. It feels more like replacing than augmenting, while the Microsoft way feels a little bit more being a more kind of consistent with the platform itself, even though it also has its own things going on, like its own way of doing menus and all those kind of things. But I do agree with that. But in general, like, I feel like with all these companies like trying to establish a design system, I feel a little bit like the core problem is that when it comes to iOS, there isn't really a design system. Like, iOS, it feels like, doesn't really have a solid design system out of the box. So if you look at Apple's app, especially the modern ones, like, you know, take, for example, the things that are happening in Wallet and the things that are happening with the new onboarding screens and all the, like, the things that they have made recently, many of them have controls and UI that doesn't exist in plain UI kit, like their buttons that they use and their different text that they use. You can't just get them for free, like you have to re-implement them. And I think that's kind of a problem where when the platform doesn't have a strong design system that you can just use, you kind of need something else, right? And that's where I think a lot of companies feel the need to invent their own design system just to have something coherent and nice.
That's a very good point, and it's something we've been talking about for a while, and it's something I feel like Apple really needs to think about, because there's pretty much no such thing as a vanilla iOS app.
Right, doesn't exist.
If you make an iOS app without customizing anything about any of the controls, any of the things on the screen, it's not very good.
It looks extremely boring, right? It's just white background color with some colored text. That's it.
Exactly. So, yeah, they should definitely think about that. And you mentioned Apple's own apps, and that's very true. You see, let's say I am a beginner and I am not an iOS developer yet, but I want to get into it. And I look at, say, music. And I look at the way they show these cards for each album on my library and the way they have this floating UI for the playback status window. And then I look into Wallet and they have these stacks of cards that I can expand, and they have this rounded plus button and this rounded font they use. So I am a beginner iOS developer. I want to do something like that. I can't, basically.
Right, exactly.
I have to spend like hours customizing controls to do that. And sometimes they even use private API for that stuff that us developers can't access. So yeah, they definitely need to work on making vanilla UI kit more appealing.
Yeah, or more powerful and more consistent, right? Like, modernizing it and bringing some new classes and some new styles that can be just used out of the box. And, you know, you talked about like browsing different apps, and one app that I think in particular really, really shows this problem is the App Store, right? Like, I've literally had like 5-6 different companies reach out to me asking me if I can build the App Store transition for them, right? The transition that happens when you click a story in the App Store and when
that's
it takes
gonna
over
take
the,
about 50 hours.
Right, exactly. And for them, like, when the customers hear this, they think I'm insane, right? Because it's like, it's right there. It's on the platform. It's by Apple, right? They assume that just because it's there, and I think honestly, that's a fair assumption, right? Like, I think ideally, if you see something in Apple's apps, you should be able to use it. That would be really great, I think, because that way you would get more consistency. You would get more apps using more of the vanilla styles, because Apple's apps, they look great. Like, they don't look boring. They look awesome. But like you say, a vanilla UI kit app looks incredibly dated and boring because there's just nothing there. It's like you just have very, very basic things like buttons with text, or table views with just text or a subtitle, an image without any rounded corners or circular images that everyone is using these days. That's all things you have to customize. So yeah, I think that if Apple would bring more of the things that they use themselves into UIKit itself, I think that would be very, very nice.
Yeah, and to their credit, like, customizing stuff on UIKit is quite easy. You can, like, if you want a rounded button, you can set the corner radius for a layer and set the background color, or you can add more layers, you can override methods. But it's kind of boring after you do it the first time and you have to keep doing that every time you want, like, a rounded button on screen to have to be repeating yourself. And I mean, what I do mainly is I end up copying code from another project.
Same, me too. The
new one. Yeah. And every like major project I have has some sort of UI framework I made myself that has all of the customization stuff, which for Chibi Studio, as you know, is the LightKit.
The LightKit, yeah. It's a fantastic
really
name.
Nice name. So, and it includes the 50-hour transition.
Nice, the classic 50-hour transition.
Yeah, so, yeah, they should definitely make it easier for us to adopt common UI patterns on iOS.
Yeah, and another kind of interesting comparison that I'd like to make is to the Mac and to AppKit. So I just said that it would be so nice if you just looked at any Apple app and you could just replicate that using the framework. And on the Mac, that's pretty much true all of the time. Like right now, I'm looking at Pages and I'm looking at Safari. And both of these apps are not trivial. Like they are, it's a web browser and a text editor, right? Like it's, they're complex apps. They have lots of controls, panels. But it's all AppKit, right? Like I can build the toolbar from Pages in Interface Builder. I can build the navigation bar in Safari pretty much using Interface Builder without any subclassing, any custom controls.
You can have the same tabbing UI you have in Safari on your app.
Exactly.
Without having to do anything.
For free, right?
Yeah.
And I think, like, you know, these days when we're talking about Marzipan and we're talking about, you know, UIKit is so much more modern and it's going to come to the Mac and everything's going to be great. And I am excited for that, too. I should just point that out. But
yeah,
I think that looking at AppKit, I feel like this is where UIKit should ideally be. Like, maybe not in terms of the API, like, you know, there's definitely things to improve there and UIKit is more modern. But just in terms of the richness of the UI controls themselves.
Yeah, that's definitely true, and I don't know if we'll get anything about that this year, but there's this project codenamed Ember, which Apple has been working on for a while, and that's the declarative UI thing we heard about from, I think, from German the first time.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, that's going to be like a layer on top of the other UI frameworks. So you write Swift code, but behind the scenes, it's going to become either AppKit stuff on the Mac, UIKit stuff on Marzipan or iOS, and WatchKit stuff on the Watch.
Nice.
And UIKit for TV as well. So that's my understanding of Ember. And so maybe they'll add, like, you can think of Ember as like these Lego pieces that you can put together, and it's going to assemble the components behind the scenes for you. You just have to declare what you want. So maybe when Ember comes out, we'll have a design language for iOS.
Awesome. Yeah, that sounds really, really promising, both from a kind of power perspective and being able to have those kind of components and things at your disposal, like we talked about. And also, like, I love declarative programming, and if Apple can build something on the system level that is really declarative, that you can just declare what you want your UI to look like and it just renders it for you, I think that could be super, super cool.
Absolutely.
Awesome. So one final thing that I wanted to talk about on this topic is a little bit like brand consistency versus platform consistency. So we talked about how Google and Microsoft and other companies, there are lots of companies building their own design systems. And these design systems are usually cross-platform. They are usually like used to identify the brand of this product, whether that's like YouTube or Spotify or whatever it might be. So I just wanted to get your take on, you mentioned earlier that you want apps to be good platform citizens and things like that, but where do you kind of draw the line? Let's say that you would bring, in a hypothetical parallel universe, you would bring Shibi Studio to Android. How would you kind of treat building that design system out, and where would you draw the line between your brand and the platform?
I think branding on apps, regardless of platform, should be limited to typefaces, colors, and of course imagery, so logos and icons and stuff like that. I don't think it should extend to UI components. I don't know if that's clear, but I've seen like many companies or people use the excuse of brand consistency to use things like Electron and React Native, which, as you know, I'm not a huge fan of.
Right.
And I really don't see that as a good explanation, a good reason, because most users and the vast majority of users are going to be using your service or product on one platform. Like, it's very rare for a single user to have both an iPhone and an Android device that they'll be using your app in. They are going to be using it on the one they have, which is either an iPhone or an Android. So having that consistency in terms of the UI itself is not that big a deal. But yeah, by all means, have brand consistency. Have the same color, the same logo, of course, the same typeface, if you want to customize the typeface, which I don't think you should. I think you should use the platform typeface. But yeah, I think that's enough for brand recognition. I don't think you need to go all the way into like having a fully custom UI component library for your brand.
Right. And another thing that I think is perhaps even more important, or definitely goes in hand with this, is also feature consistency. And the ironic thing is that I've seen a lot of companies spend a lot of time on the brand consistency and syncing the UI and the visuals across platforms, but then they don't have feature parity across platforms. And this for me is the number one thing, where you say that most people won't use both Android and iOS, and that's true, but there's a lot of times where, like, you're out with your friends, for example, right? And one person uses Android and one person uses iOS, and you want to share something within the same app, or let's say it's a game you maybe want to play together or something like that. And so many times that doesn't work because the app doesn't have the same features on both platforms. And I feel like that's really, like, if your company shipping an app on multiple platforms, sure, make sure like the brand is consistent, that things look you know, similar or follows your brand. But where I would put most of my effort is not to invent a super complicated design system, but rather to make sure that the apps stay the same in terms of features.
Yeah, exactly. And answering your previous question, if I was going to make in a parallel universe Shibi Studio for Android, I would definitely be following whatever Google says is the right way to design Android apps. I suppose they have a design guideline. I suppose material design is the standard, and I would definitely be following that and use the colors and the icons and things like that to make the app recognizable. And of course, the feature parity. One thing to be careful about with feature parity is to not eliminate features from a platform, from a product, just because they can't be implemented on both platforms. So let's say, oh, we're not gonna implement Siri intent support because that's not on Android.
Right. Yeah, that's a good counterpoint. Absolutely.
Yeah, don't do that. Like, if there's a feature that can only be implemented on one platform, by all means, do it for that platform. But if it's possible on both, do it on both.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good point. And it doesn't affect that scenario that I was talking about earlier, where you as an iOS user want to interact with an Android user using the same app, because if you're using something that only exists within the iOS world, then that's fine, right? Like, you will only use that with other iOS users or just on your own device.
Yeah, exactly. Like, on one of the things we do on my jobby job is all the like deep linking stuff is completely universal between Android and iOS. So
yeah,
if you have a link you shared from the Android app, the iOS app has to be able to open that link.
Yeah,
and vice
absolutely.
Versa. So those things are very important, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so next up, we want to do this week's edition of the Ramble Report. But before we do, let's take a very quick break and thank this episode's sponsor, which is our good friends at Volta Charger. Now, there are two things I want to tell you about here. First is that 9to5 Mac has teamed up with Volta to do an Apple Watch Series 4 giveaway, which we'll put a link to in the show notes. And second is that we have an exclusive 10% discount on Volta's brand new magnetic USB cable with interchangeable connectors. The cable is called Volta 2.0 and is a 5-amp cable with magnetic connectors that allow you to easily switch from USB to USB-C to Lightning, all with a single cable for all of your devices. It's a charge and sync cable, and has a standard USB connector on one end, and on the other end, there's an open magnet where you can attach different types of connectors. This cable comes with a lifetime warranty from Volta, and they also sell extra tips for USB-C, micro-USB, and Lightning. So what's really great about this cable is that if you, like me, miss the good old days when we had MacBooks with MagSafe, this is a great way to bring that back to your Mac. Or you can just use this cable to cut down on the number of other cables that you would otherwise need to carry, for example, while traveling, since you'll be able to change this cable to fit your needs. So make sure to check this cable out. It's again called the Volta 2.0. It's a magnetic USB cable. And as an exclusive offer for all of you wonderful Stacktrace listeners, you'll get a 10% discount by going to voltacharger.com/stacktrace. And then use promo code 9to5take10 at checkout. Again, that's voltacharger.com/stacktrace and promo code 9to5take10 for 10% off Volta's magnetic USB cable. And also make sure to check out Volta and 9to5 Max Apple Watch giveaway, which you can find in the show notes as well. Thanks so much to Volta for sponsoring Stacktrace. All right, Rambo, so what have you got for us this week in the Rambo Report? Which I think this week will also be a little bit the German Report. Is that right?
Yeah, that's definitely true, because good friend of the show, Mark German, just released a new report with a lot of stuff. So I think we have a lot to unpack, but there is a little bit of overlap between my previous reports and what he reported on, but there are some new stuff, and I think we should focus on the new stuff. What do you think, John?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do that. Because we already talked about some of these things, like some of the redesigns coming with iOS 13 and the things that you were reporting on during the week of scoops, right? So yeah. What's new? Tell me, like, what's the new things here that you see that you haven't seen before or that you haven't been talking about before in your reports?
So the main source of new things in his report is about watchOS 6, which I had not talked about in my reports, at least not in as much detail as he did. So let's start talking about this. So Apple is going to be adding an App Store app to the Apple Watch on watchOS 6. That's cool, right?
Yeah, that's super cool. And it also says here in the report that it's going to make the device more independent, which, you know, makes sense, right? If you have an app store, you could theoretically, like, be out without your iPhone and install new apps, which really fulfills my dream that I've talked about since getting the new Apple Watch, which is really to be able to use the Apple Watch as a standalone device.
Now, we were talking about during our trip, and I was actually wrong, because I think I told you that it was already possible to release a watchOS app without an enclosing iOS app. But I was wrong. It's not. So if you create a new watchOS app in Xcode, it actually creates an iOS app that has a watchOS app inside of it. And it's not just a shell app like it does with Messages, because with Messages apps, you can actually make a standalone Messages app. It does go inside an iOS app, but it's an empty iOS app that's just used for distribution, but it doesn't show up in the home screen or anything, and you can only buy it in the Messages app store. But that's not true for watchOS apps. It does create a an iOS app with it, and the iOS app actually has to be functional. So,
right.
And the watchOS app store that shows up inside the watch app on your phone is just like filtering the app store for apps that have a watchOS app inside of them. So I suppose that with the standalone app store inside watchOS, they will start allowing us developers to make watchOS apps that don't have an associated iOS app. So they're going to be standalone watchOS apps that only show up in the watchOS app store.
Yeah, I think that's super cool. And I think it also is healthy for the watch as a platform to kind of, you know, fly out of the bird's nest a little bit, right?
Yeah.
To stand on its own. Because so many apps have historically, for good reasons, because like in the early days of watchOS, you really needed the iPhone app to be like the brains behind the operation, right? And so many apps are still structured that way. You open them up on the Apple Watch and they just say, sign in using your iPhone, right? Or do this using your iPhone. And as someone like me who really wants to use the Apple Watch of its own, like, you know, as an independent thing, it's kind of disappointing, right? And I would love for the system to really say, okay, let's separate, let's cut the cord, and let's make sure that Apple Watch apps are their own thing from now on. You'll still probably be able to still share a lot of logic and to really use the phone app if you want, but to have the default be that these are standalone apps, I think that could be really healthy for the platform.
Yeah, and there are many apps that are watch specific, but they still have an iOS app that's usually like just a settings screen for the app or just
tutorial.
Something. Yeah,
yeah,
tutorial, but it's not useful in any way. So for those apps, I think it makes sense. It would make sense for them to be just watchOS apps. And I really feel like this is one of the moves in the direction of having standalone mode for Apple Watch available to everyone.
Yeah.
We know that Apple engineers have access to a standalone mode on watchOS that doesn't require a phone. But they are definitely working towards opening that up to users as well. I'm not sure if it's going to happen this year. I would say it's more likely it won't because there are lots of things to solve. But maybe next year, I think it's possible that we'll see this standalone mode for watchOS coming to all users.
Yeah, and we have to remember that this kind of cord that exists right now between the iPhone and the Apple Watch, this very strong connection, it also used to exist between the Mac and the iPhone, right? So it's almost like the exact same thing happening here where in the early days, you couldn't just buy an iPhone and just turn it on and go through the onboarding and use it. You had to connect it to iTunes. But these days, I bet most iPhone and iPad users never ever connects their iPhone or iPad to the Mac to iTunes, except if they have some kind of problem. And I feel like this is just a natural evolution of the product, and the same thing is happening with the watch.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I think these days, if you connect to the iPhone to your Mac, it's to use your Mac as the most expensive charging brick.
Right, exactly. A really great power bank. Cool. So there's also a lot of other cool things here happening. It says that you're going to get an emoji and Memoji stickers. There's going to be an Apple Books app, voice memos. Yeah, there's a bunch of different apps coming and things like moving over from the iPhone to the Apple Watch.
I think we can highlight calculator.
Right.
Friend James Thompson, I'm sure he's happy about that.
Yeah.
But I was talking to James about, and I told him that this was happening. And the conclusion we came to was that it was probably going to be good for pCalc, because now people would be aware that they can have a calculator on their Apple Watch. So maybe they'll try to use the calculator and they'll miss some feature and they'll go to the now built-in app store and find pCalc.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very common that happens. And you see this all the time when Apple is quote-unquote Sherlocking something, right? Like they are implementing something that some other third-party app was doing, and it's the end of the third-party app, right? That app is doomed now. And sometimes it can happen, especially if it's something that really requires a lot of system-level access that only Apple can get. But so many of the times, like when Apple builds an app for something, it's usually, like you say, a very simple version of it. And it can just cause the pie, the market that everyone is competing over, to just grow, because there will be more users realizing, oh, I can use a calculator on my Apple Watch. That's super cool. And just checking out third-party apps. And like you say, it can just lead to actual growth for even the third party, even though at first it might have seemed quite the opposite.
Yeah, and by the way, you mentioned Apple Books. We should just explain that it's for audiobooks. So you're not going to be reading books on your Apple Watch.
You're not going to sit there on the bus and read a book on the watch. That would actually look very funny.
Yeah, so don't worry. It's just for audiobooks.
Reading Game of Thrones, one letter at a time.
and some new health-related apps. There's going to be an app called Dose, the internal name is Dose, that's for medication reminders, and one for menstrual cycles for women. So I think that's going to be, those two are going to be big features for health.
It's again, I can really see this being like a Jeff Williams segment, right, where he comes up and he talks about their health initiative, maybe shows off some university things they've been working on together with the scientific community, and then he talks about these new apps, right? Because that seems to be like a running segment now during WWDC.
Yeah, definitely. And it's probably going to be the first segment for software, which is what they usually do.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Yeah, seems like to be a pretty interesting release for the watch. I'm especially like the individual apps. That's cool. Like I'm excited about those. But the thing that I'm the most excited about is that separation and just really making the platform more powerful. And you know, there are two things that we're always speculating about whenever there's a new WWDC, which is, will we see custom watch faces or will we see UI kits for Apple Watch? Right. And probably none of those this time, but you know, this goes along those lines of that evolution of the platform, which I'm just really excited to see, because I really feel like the watch has still kind of a long way to go to really become like its own platform that stands on its own two feet, or stands on its own watch band, maybe, I don't know. And I would love to see that, so I'm excited about those things.
Yeah, definitely. So watchOS 6, definitely a really, really cool release. And there's also some information that HomePod might be getting multi-user support.
Yeah, and how do you feel about this as being a HomePod owner? A HomePod owner with one person in the house. You can speak with different voices to it now.
Yeah, I'm not going to be very useful to me. I mean, unless there's like a guest mode, I guess that could be useful for when I have guests. But I'm sure that most people live with other people. So having the ability to have multiple accounts synced up to the HomePod, and depending on who's speaking for like reminders and things like that, it's going to act and add that reminder, for instance, to the person's personal reminders, or the other person, if it's the other person speaking. I think that's going to be really cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something that has been long requested since the HomePod came out. And, you know, it kind of also ties into that science fiction dream, right? That anyone in the family can just shout out a command into the air and the HomePod will pick it up and do it, right? Regardless of who said it. So if I say, you know, remind me to buy this thing tomorrow, then it's going to remind me, not everyone else in the family.
Yeah, I'm also curious to know how it would handle shared family things. Like if you have a family shopping list, how does it know whether it's going to add something to your personal list or to the family list? I guess you'll have to explicitly say to add milk to the family shopping list or something.
Yeah, I don't think that would be a problem, because if it's a shared list, like me and my girlfriend, we have a shared reminders list for shopping. And the way it works is that these are also local lists that appear in our reminders, right? So if I say add X to my shopping list, it adds that to that shared list. So it would only be a problem if you had one list called shopping list, which is your own, and then another one, which is also called shopping list. I don't know if that's possible, but if it is, but then you're just, you know, you've put yourself in that situation. So I think you would need to use better namespacing. We know that as developers, right? Namespacing is really key here.
You'll penta yourself into a groceries corner.
Exactly, exactly. So exciting stuff for a HomePod. And what about the Mac? There's a bunch of new things here as well for the Mac, right?
Yeah, so I mentioned before on my report about the new Apple Music app coming to the Mac. And so Mark says that it's going to be a standard Mac app. And I guess by standard, he means not Marzipan, right?
Well, Marzipan is the new standard, Rambo. Welcome the new standard, same as the old standard, right?
Yeah, so that lines up with information I've got after I released my report, which I if you remember, that was my first post of the series of reports. And what I heard is that, and this is the Rambo part of the report, is that it's actually going to be a transformation of iTunes.
Oh, interesting. So iTunes is still going to be there, or this will actually just be the new iTunes, like the next version of iTunes?
You're going to have to download another version of iTunes if you need legacy iTunes stuff. Just
Ooh,
like you have to do it now for like the App Store, if you want the built-in App Store in iTunes.
Right, and also similar to QuickTime, right? Where there are still people who are clinging on to the old version of QuickTime because it had a lot of more features, and the new version of QuickTime is more streamlined version of that, right? So maybe it could be something similar here where the version of iTunes you get by default is this new streamlined version, but then if you want all the other things, you would have to go back to the previous one.
Yeah, but it's not going to be called iTunes. It's going to be called Music.
Right, got it.
Yeah. And a detail that people have been asking a lot, and I happen to know that this new Music app will have support for device management.
Right.
So you will be able to sync your stuff using this app.
Right. So I wonder, because, you know, when an iPhone exhibits a problem, it shows this screen that says, plug me into iTunes, please, right? And I mean, it's still iTunes doesn't make a lot of sense for, you know, device management, but arguably Music makes even less sense, right? So I'm wondering if that kernel panic screen or whatever you want to call it shows Music, like, hey, plug this iPhone into Music, right? Like, I feel like, will that be even more confusing? What do you think?
It's technically the recovery screen.
The recovery screen, right.
Yeah. So that image is in the restore image for the OS. So probably iOS 13 is going to have a different image there. But I'm not sure to which extent this device management in the new Music app on the Mac will be implemented. If it's going to be maybe just for Music stuff. And if you want to do other things, you're going to either have to use iTunes, so the legacy iTunes, or if they're going to have you use Apple Configurator for that. Because there is an app already that can do lots of things with iOS devices. It's called Apple Configurator.
Yeah, that makes more sense, right? To have a dedicated app for when you need to, you know, give like some emergency aid to your dying device. To have like some kind of a device management app that you use, or like maybe renaming it to like a device first aid or whatever, you know, like having something that's more obvious that this is for device management rather than iTunes or Music.
Yes. And this stuff is in front of this system framework called Mobile Device. So the functionality of communicating with the device over USB and things like that is all on the system itself. So it's not necessarily that you need iTunes to do that stuff. You have Apple Configurator that can do that stuff, and you will have at least some limited device management in the new music app.
Awesome. Yeah, that's really exciting.
Oh, and by the way, I'm sure many people are going to be very happy about this. You are going to be able to rip and burn CDs using the new music app.
Hooray! If you can find a Mac that has a CD drive, that is. That's step one.
So for all of those out there who are still wanting to burn and rip CDs using your Mac, don't worry. You'll be able to do that.
Oh, I'm relieved. I'm very relieved that I can use my Discman still, you know, walking around with that in my pocket. Yeah, absolutely. That's the only real way to listen to music, right?
Exactly.
All right. Anything else in this report, or is it all? Are we all done? Are we all scooped up now?
I think that's enough for now. We'll see if any other news come up. But I think we're good for today.
All right, so we're going to see what's going to happen next in the world of scoops. It's been really fascinating so far to see just how much information is already available about all the things from WWDC that we know about or we think are going to happen from people like you and German. So let's see what's going to happen next. But what's going to happen next in this episode of this show is one of our favorite segments. And it's, of course, Ask Stacktrace. Are you ready, Rambo?
I am ready.
Awesome. So we want to thank everyone who's been sending us questions. We've been getting much more questions lately, which we are super excited about. And if you have a question for us, you can just tweet it with the hashtag AskStackTrace. And we're going to try to spend more and more time on answering your questions, because these are really good questions and we'd love to talk about them. So keep sending them in. And the first question for this episode comes from Lewis. And Lewis says that he keeps hearing about this new Springboard with widgets for iOS 13, but that they only will be for the iPad. Is this true? And if so, why might this be? Because Android phones has widgets on the home screen, so why wouldn't the iPhone be able to do this? What do you think about this, Rambo?
Well, first of all, we don't know about widgets necessarily. It's a possibility. It's kind of obvious. It's an obvious thing to think about, but I haven't heard anything about widgets in the home screen for iPad. So it's definitely going to be different. But how different and what the difference is going to be is a little bit unsure at the moment. But let's assume that you'll be able to have some sort of widget in the new Springboard on iPad. The first thing we have to think about is space limitation. You have iPhones. I mean, the XS Max has the screen is quite big, but it's still a lot smaller than an iPad. So you lose a lot of space if you start adding widgets. And with regards to Android, it's another OS, so you can't compare. Like,
right?
It's, yeah.
Talk and, about respecting platform guidelines, right?
Yeah, and what I heard about that is that many people, the most Android installations, and I could be wrong about this because I'm not an Android person, but as far as I know, most Android installations have this weather widget as the default widget that they have on the home screen. And they usually also have this prominent Google search bar thing.
Yeah.
Which on iOS is replaced by Spotlight, which you can get by pulling down on the home screen, which I believe is a better way to do it because then you don't have that search thing all the time there. And what I heard is that the vast majority of users never customize the widget on the home screen. So that tells me that people are not really into that. I'm sure there are people who are, and I'm sure people who listen to Stacktrace are more likely to be into that kind of stuff because
right.
the people who like to fiddle with things. But Yeah, I just think it doesn't make much sense on iPhone, at least not in a way I can see it. Maybe Apple can see a way that it could be cool or different, and they are working on that. But yeah, I just don't see how it would be useful, really.
Yeah, it's either a case of people don't want to customize or people just really like seeing the weather, right? Like, yeah. There's a reason why in almost every conversation that has ever happened in the history of mankind, there's always a mention of the weather, right? Because it's so central to our days, right?
Yeah.
So I think it does make sense that a lot of people would prefer to have the weather there. I certainly would. It's my top widget in my kind of widget strip that you get on iOS when you swipe over to that screen. But yeah, I do agree with you. It might be also a little bit of a kind of power user feature. It might be a little bit a case of discoverability, right? Like, how do you know that you can add a widget? Like, most people might look at that weather widget and just think, well, it's just part of the phone, right? Or part of the OS, like, it's just there. So, but I personally would think, like, we talked about it on the show, and maybe this is where Lewis got this information, where we were actually talking and speculating without any real, like, concrete evidence, but rather just, you know, a thought experiment of having widgets and having these apps that can render themselves as a different surface on the home screen and be more persistent. Like I said on previous episodes, I'm a huge fan of this idea. I'm honestly not sure how much I would use it in practice. You know, like everything, you have to wait and see what it actually turns out to be. But I do like the idea of being able to persist some information on the home screen, either temporarily or just permanently for things like weather.
Yeah, it's just like I was thinking about it now and looking at my iPhone's home screen, and every single icon I have in the first page is very important to me. Like, I launch all icons with a certain amount of frequency that it makes sense to have them all in the first page. And if I want to see the weather, I just swipe to the left and I have Carrot Weather, which is my favorite weather app. I have it in there. So I don't, and if I compare the sizes, it would have to remove like 12 icons from my home screen to fit the widget as it is in there. Yeah. So I'm not sure I'm willing to do that trade-off.
Right, exactly. Absolutely. It's very tricky in terms of space, and you could experiment with things like, you know, you maybe have a widget and you tap on it and it auto-expands, kind of like how the 3D touch thing is supposed to work, but maybe in a more discoverable manner, I don't know. Or you could place your widgets on like your second home screen, but then how is it different from swiping, you know, to the today view that we have today? So yeah, it is tricky, and I think it makes more sense on the iPad in general, because on the iPad you have a lot of space, and you could also really see the space between icons on Springboard on the iPad could also be smaller without it being uncomfortable.
Exactly, and that's like the main thing. If you look at an iPhone's home screen, at least in my opinion, it makes sense. It makes sense the way it is. The iPad home screen, on the other hand, doesn't make any sense. Like, these huge icons with lots of space in between them.
Because it's still a phone home screen, right? It's still just the exact same phone home screen.
Yeah, because the iPad is more of a computer, really. And I rarely, completely differently from my iPhone, I rarely tap any icons in the home screen on my iPad. I usually use Spotlight. And I use like command space on the keyboard to launch Spotlight, type the name of the app and that, and launch it. So the icons on my iPad's home screen are not that useful to me. And that's completely different from my iPhone, which I use all the time. So I take it out of my pocket, I unlock it, and I have like all the main apps I want to use right there. But with the iPad, it's a completely different story.
Yeah, I think it's also fair to say that the session time, like the amount of time you spend each session with the device, is probably much larger on the iPad on average. And I would also guess that every time the average user uses their iPad, they tend to just be in one or maybe a handful of apps, right? Where you might just be using the iPad to watch Netflix, or in my case, to like write an article or to browse the web. But on the iPhone, you're usually bouncing more between different apps. You're like maybe checking something out on a blog, and then you are in Twitter tweeting about it, and then you jump over to Messages to send a message. Like, sure, you could do those things on the iPad as well, but it feels more like you say, the iPad is more like a computer where you spend more time on each task, so the home screen and the direct access to all those apps there is not as relevant as it is on the iPhone?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, and I think that's the main reason why it would make sense to have widgets, whatever they look like, we don't know, or on an iPad and not on the iPhone.
Yeah, absolutely. So our next question comes from Oscar, and Oscar wants to know if we think that there's any chance that we'll see this new functional RX Swift-like UI library during this year's WWDC.
No.
So Rambo, what do you think? that's a quick answer.
I don't see why Apple would do something like that, and it's very different from the way most Apple APIs work, and I just don't see why Apple would do something like that, especially when there are really, really cool third-party libraries that do it.
Yeah, but at the same time, we got Swift, right? Like, Swift was a bomb that was just dropped on us. No one knew it was coming. There were no leaks. Because these are the type of things that can really be kept very, very secret. Because you can almost have, at least for an initial beta release, you could almost just have the people working on the library and maybe just a handful of app developers know about it.
Let me change my answer a little bit.
Sure.
Not before Amber.
Oh, right. Got it. But isn't Amber this? Like, isn't those two the same thing?
Kinda. So Apple has been hiring people for the Amber project, and they ask for people who are familiar with Swift and functional UI programming and reactive programming. So I guess it's a component of Amber. So the main thing with Amber is the declarative UI thing. But the way you respond to events in this when using this declarative UI thing would be probably more reactive than it is right now.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it really sounds like these two things go hand in hand. Because if you're going to define your UI declaratively, you kind of also need your code to be declarative and reactive, right? Where, for example, if you're saying, here's my data, and this data contains this text, this button, this action, you wouldn't be able to like assign a delegate to it like you do in the current API design. You would need to have some kind of events that you bind to that then get triggered, and this is how you react to the taps and things like that. So at least from my perspective, when I look at this, it really feels like these are very strongly connected.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Cool. So our final question comes from Simon. And Simon wants to know, how do we prepare for WWDC? And I think this will be an interesting one because we are going to experience WWDC in very different ways. None of us is actually going to the actual conference, but you're going to be there in San Jose at AltConf. You're going to be there during the week. So first I want to hear, as someone who's traveling there, how are you preparing for this?
We talked about this during our trip, and it's complicated because the best way to experience WWDC is to be home with your Wi-Fi, with your computer on your desk, and just watch the videos.
Reading Swift by Sundell.
You read, listen to Stack Trace, read 9to5 Mac, follow me on Twitter, follow John, and that's it. But then, like, I will be there, and I'm sure I would be able to absorb more content being home. But I'm also sure that if I wasn't going there, I would see all of these pictures of my friends that I know who are going to be there, and they're having coffee together, and there's ATP Live and Connected Live and the talk show with John Gruber Live, and I would be like, oh, I so wanted to be there. So that's why I am going.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that it's easier to absorb the actual content, to learn about the APIs, to learn about, you know, everything that's new. If you can just sit down and read, you know, articles about it, you can watch videos about it, you can try it out in a playground yourself. But you can't absorb the atmosphere of being there, right? You can't talk to people, you can't experience the actual conference. And that's why you would go to WWDC, right? To get that experience.
Yeah, the main reason I wanted to attend WWDC itself, which I'm not going to because I didn't get a ticket, was to go to the keynote. That was the main reason. Because sessions, you can watch the videos. I hear some people saying that they are able to take more advantage of the sessions live there, because if they try to watch the video, they can't because they get distracted or something. That doesn't happen with me. I am perfectly capable of following many, many session videos just fine.
Yeah.
Especially since you can use a 2x speed on my WWDC app for macOS.
Exactly.
Yeah. So sessions, that's out of the question. Labs, you have to have a very specific reason for going to labs. And I've heard so many stories of people waiting like an hour in a line to finally get to talk to someone in a lab, and the final result being file a radar.
Right.
That, like, I wouldn't spend time with that. So the main cool things about actually attending would probably be actually seeing the keynote live, which is probably fun, and meeting people. I can meet people without attending. And the keynote part, there's no replacement for that, but oh well, I'll just watch the streaming. And I'll be watching it at AltConf. They do this streaming thing, so I'll probably be there. And so there's going to be people. By the way, I met quite a few people at NS North who said they're going to AltConf, so that's really cool. And yeah, so attending WWDC itself is not that big a deal, but being there, being nearby, and be going to AltConf and all the other events that happen around it, that's really, really cool, because then you get to do the networking part of going to WWDC without attending WWDC. And in terms of preparation, I'm not exactly sure what Simon meant by preparation. Is that like
preparing? Packing your bag.
Yeah, packing your bag.
Making sure you have a lot of water, ready to rehydrate. Odwalla, I've heard, is good.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Shout out to Casey. I actually tried the Mango Tango. It's
cool. It was good?
Yeah, really good. So my preparation is definitely very different from other people's preparation. There's lots of spelunking that goes on right before WWDC because of my app and because I am me. And also, like, for 9to5, we need to be ready to post about stuff that's announced at WWDC. So there's some research that needs to be done to make sure that when something gets announced, I have the context to understand the announcement and explain it to other people, because that's kind of my job in a way. And also, like, make sure I have enough free space on my Mac to download the new Xcode and the new betas and things like that. And yeah, I mean, since I'm traveling, making sure I have all the cables I need, the USB-C to Ethernet adapter if I need that. That's basically it, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, preparing to go to something like WWDC is very much like preparing to go to any trip. I guess you would also kind of make a list of, you know, what are the events I want to attend? What are the people that I want to try to meet? What are my goals, really, right? And that's something that I do for almost any trip that I take. I always ask myself, like, what's the reason I'm going on this trip if it's not a vacation trip? Like, what do I want to get out of this? Like, who do I want to meet? What kind of conversations do I want to have? Do I maybe want to meet someone specifically or ask them something or work on something with someone? You know, if you have these kind of goals, that's usually a good thing, because you will be more focused and you will have more like a sense of, you know, accomplishment when you also get home, because you can check things off the checklist and you can say, I met Rambo. Great. Check, you know, and these things. So I think that's usually good to do if you're preparing to actually go to WWDC.
Yeah. By the way, everyone who's listening, feel free to add meet Rambo to your reminders.
Right. Exactly. Tell Siri that right now. Yeah.
Yeah.
So for me, it's going to be a little bit different because I am not actually going to WWDC. I wish I was, but this year I'm not. And one reason that I'm not is because I have some really big plans on how I want to cover the conference and how I want to cover all the things that were announced. So I'm really going to try to make my site, Swift by Sundell, kind of one of the primary places that you would go to read about all the new things that were announced. So last year I did one new article every day during WWDC, and that was fun. That was a fun challenge to myself. And I did that while also working as a freelancer back then. But now Swift by Sundell is my full-time job, so I'll be able to do so much more. And I really want to try to make the experience of people who are just like, maybe not like us, like watching every single video, absorbing everything, but the people who just want to know, like, what's new? What's going on? Like, what do I need to know? Like, those are the things that I want to try to answer on my site this year. And that's why I'm saying, like, when I'm saying it's like going to be, try to be like the primary place to go to for those types of questions. So I'm going to create a dedicated site. It's going to be really cool, I think. I'm going to launch it, a few days before. There's going to be lots of different kind of content there. I'm going to talk more about it on upcoming episodes. I'm still kind of figuring it out, but I'm planning something really big. And it wouldn't make any sense for me to do all of those things if I was going, because that would mean I would just spend thousands of dollars on going to WWDC, getting a hotel room, just to sit in the hotel room and produce content, right? So since I'm not going, I'm trying to use that as the best way I can, just to help the community and to help people who really just want to kind of catch up with the conference, because there's so many things that's going to happen during that week. So I want to try to like you say, to use the context I have reading about all these things to inform as many other people as I can.
I will be in part doing what you said, like paying thousands of dollars to be there just to sit and work.
The most expensive co-working space ever.
Yeah, because I have to do it to some extent.
Yeah, that's true. You can't just completely drop everything.
Exactly. So, and I have to keep an eye out for what's happening. I'll have to spelunk the new OSs. Because that's expected, and that's kind of my job again. So yeah, I'll be doing that, and I'll be attending AltConf. I also submitted something for the call for papers at AltConf. I'm not sure if I am going to end up speaking, but if they accept my proposal, I am. So there's going to be that as well, which should be fun. So yeah, that's the gist of it, and I'm sure new things are going to appear that require changing plans as well. One thing I should also mention, there could be hardware at WWDC.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's like another thing, like, will I want to buy anything to bring home? So then I have to plan, like, I need to have enough credit available to buy the stuff, and I need to like be thinking about which Apple Store am I going to go to. Maybe I should extend my stay a little bit longer so I can get stuff shipped to the hotel or something. So that's another aspect. Especially if you're traveling from another country, if you're going to want to buy any new stuff that's announced, that's assuming it becomes available immediately, you should also plan for that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to share a lot more about our plans for WWDC and what's going on in future episodes before WWDC. So we still have a few weeks to go, and I definitely want to share more about my plans as well and what I'm planning to do with this new dedicated site for WWDC. So I'm really excited about it. I'm working on it, and I'm sure, Rambo, you're going to have more things to talk about as well before your big trip. But for now, this is it, and we want to thank you all so much for listening to Stacktrace. If you enjoyed this episode, please just take a quick moment to maybe share it with friends, share it on social media, or, you know, rate it or review it on iTunes. Whatever you can do, it really, really helps us a lot. And we also want to thank our good friends at Volta for sponsoring this episode and enabling us to bring it to you all of you every single week. So thanks so much. You can find us on Twitter. I am at John Sundell. You can find Mr. Rambo at _inside. You can find Rambo's fine writing at 95mac.com. And you can find my writing at swiftbysundell.com. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. And say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.